This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 103, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And every Thursday, I release an episode called UFO Encounters, so please check them out. If you want to hear the extended version of this interview, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign. Well, there are now more than 100 episodes in the back catalogue. For $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to Robert Salas about his book, UAPs and the Nuclear Puzzle, Visitations, National Security, and the Need for Transparency. Robert is a 1964 graduate of the US Air Force Academy. He served 7 years on active duty. He worked as a weapons controller, flew target drones, commanded intercontinental ballistic missiles as a launch officer, and has worked as an Air Force missile propulsion engineer on the Titan III program. Hi, Bob. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
You bet, Simon. I'm happy to be here.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called UAPs and the Nuclear Puzzle: Visitations, National Security, and the Need for Transparency. First of all, what I want to ask you about is the title. What did you mean by nuclear puzzle?
Well, the puzzle, I guess, is why there have been so many documented cases of UFOs interacting or flying over or in some way interested in our nuclear weapons and even our nuclear power facilities. So that's the focus of my book, and actually the focus of my most recent efforts in disclosure. I think it's important. There have been many incidents. I think I've listed at least a dozen in this book where UFOs have come over and had some interaction with nuclear weapons.
And is this something that you're aware of happening all around the world? Did the Soviets get it? Did it happen in Britain?
Yes, it happened in Britain. It happened in other places in the world, Italy, the Netherlands. In Britain, you're familiar with the Rendlesham Forest incident.
Yeah.
I'm sure. On one of those evenings, the UFO was seen by some airmen in a tower near the nuclear weapons storage facility. Now, at that time, Britain was part of a NATO force, of course, that had the capability of arming aircraft with nuclear weapons in the event that was necessary. And so on one of those evenings during the Rendlesham incident in 1980, a UFO came over and shone a beam of light at one of the locations where nuclear weapons were stored. I think this has been validated by not only those two witnesses in the tower nearby, but also Colonel Holt has alluded to that. Colonel Holt, of course, was one of the main witnesses in that case.
Could you tell us how you got affected, first of all, with your interest? Is it from Maelstrom, or did you have any experiences before that?
No, I had no experiences before the Maelstrom incident, which happened in my case in March 24th, to be exact, of 1967. I was a U.S. Air Force missile launch officer assigned to Maelstrom and assigned to a crew, what we called a missile combat crew. And on that evening, I was at a place called Oscar Flight, which is simply an underground launch control center where we would be monitoring and, of course, affect the launch of nuclear missiles if so given that order. We were never given that order, of course. But on that evening, I was in command when I got a phone call from my topside guard. We were 60 feet underground. We had about six guards up top. And he reported that there were some strange lights in the sky hovering above the bay of the facility. Strange maneuvers, very fast, stopping in midair, reversing course, making 90-degree turns, things we've heard since pilots of the military pilots had reported their sightings fairly recently. At any rate, I was not interested in the UFO subject at the time, although we had had reporting in the local newspaper. This was near Great Falls, Montana. We had reporting from various citizens that, of lights in the sky. And again, doing strange things. So I had heard about these lights, but this was the first experience I had with them. I thanked the security guard for the information, was not really all that interested, but then, so I hung up the call, and then about 5 minutes later or so, the next call came, and this time he was very frightened. I could tell by his voice, he was extremely frightened, had all the guards with their weapons drawn, and he said, "Sir, we're looking at a glowing red-orange object pulsating just above the front gate of our facility." And he wanted me to tell him what to do next. I was kind of shocked at the report, but it was certainly a serious report. It was not any kind of a joke. In fact, they had no ability to effectuate anything with regard to the missiles upstairs. We had all the controls downstairs. But at any rate, he was very frightened. I told him to make sure nothing entered the enclosed facility. There, it was obviously fenced, and to take whatever action he felt necessary. So he hung up because he had to go take care of a guard that got injured. This injury was not anything to do with the UFO, except that it probably had to do with some error or mistake. He had the guard with either his weapon or cut himself. It was a cut on the hand. At any rate, he had to go and hung up the phone. I immediately woke up my commander, who was taking a rest break. One of us had to be fully alert at all times, and the other could take a short rest break. And so I woke him up. And as I was starting to tell him about these phone calls, we got some bells and whistles and going off alarms. We both knew what that meant. It meant there was some problem with the missiles. So we took a look at our status board, and sure enough, the missiles were now going down. By going down, I meant they were no longer launchable. So we had a status reporting system. They were all reporting guidance and control system failure. And this was happening all happening while the object was still above us. We also had a couple of lights showing possible incursions at two of the facilities. The missiles themselves were at what we call the launch facilities. And they're located about a mile or two away from this launch control center. But we had to send guards out to those two facilities where they had possible incursions. And when the guards reported back, they reported seeing these strange lights out there at those facilities. And then my commander called the command post at the base. We were about 100 miles to the east of Great Falls, Malmstrom Air Force Base. But of course, he had reported this incident, and they told him that the same thing had happened previously. Oh, well, same thing had happened at another flight. And he told me that. I thought he meant that evening, but later on I realized and found out it happened 8 days earlier, and that was called the Echo flight. So very similar incident to mine, except they had security guards and maintenance people that had stayed overnight at two of those launch facilities. In the morning, they reported seeing UFOs above them. And within seconds of that report, all 10 of their missiles went down. So within the span of 8 days, 20 nuclear weapons, intercontinental ballistic missiles were disabled as a result of UFO encounters.
While this was all going on, I believe you say in the book that you remember looking at the status board and you heard some kind of communication as though it was telepathic coming from the UFO.
Well, I don't know that I heard anything. What I sensed after the guard hung up the phone, I immediately turned and looked at the status board, and I felt something might be happening with our missiles shortly. It was just a feeling. But like I said, they had no control over the status of the missiles upstairs. But I do remember having that feeling, and it could very well have been some sort of a communication, a telepathic communication, I suppose. Just speculation.
Okay. And so were all the 10 missiles there completely independent? It's not like they were part of a network, so if one goes down, they all go down?
That's right. They weren't in what's called in series. The missiles were independent. We had independent cables, very large cables. I think they're about 8 or 9 inches in diameter. And these cables were triply shielded against electromagnetic interference. So this object would have had to send a signal to each of those missiles separately, penetrating 60 feet of earth and concrete, and then penetrating these triply shielded cables, because that's the only way we had of communicating with those missiles, and send a particular signal to a particular piece of hardware, which was later identified by Boeing inspectors as the potential culprit for why the missile shut down. It was part of the guidance system, and it was interrupted intermittently, and that's why the missiles shut down. There was no damage to the missiles themselves or the equipment. Nothing was damaged or burned up or, you know, nothing like that. It was simply the fact that we had what's called an inertial guidance system, which is dependent after launch on the onboard equipment to determine its direction, speed, et cetera, and orientation. And this logic coupler was part of that system. And it was upset momentarily by a signal. And that's the best I can do with that explanation, because even though the Air Force did do a report, of course, on these incidents, that report remains classified to this day.
There were a number of people there, and you have come forward and talked about it. Have any of the other guys that were involved come forward?
My commander, retired Colonel Fred Mywald, who's now deceased, supported what I have just told you in an audio tape that recorded a conversation we had by telephone in 1996, and somewhat in writing. I received a couple of notes from him. He backed up my story, and but I have not heard from any of the guards since, well, the day after the incident. They did call me at home and asked and pleaded for me to come and see them and talk more about what they experienced. Not that I could have shed any more light on the subject. By the way, I couldn't, but I couldn't speak with them because I'd signed a non-disclosure agreement immediately after we got back to the base that next morning. So I would have broken that and been subject to prosecution for speaking to anybody about this incident.
What about getting the missiles back online? Was that just a flick of the switch, or did you have technicians in?
No, we had to send crews out to each of the missiles and go through a particular procedure to make sure the missiles were aligned properly, that the equipment was operating properly, and get them back on alert status. So that was a process that probably took 24 hours or so to get all the missiles back up on alert.
And also, was there a guy called Airman Sidney Young, and he had a sighting that was close by?
Oh, Airman Young, he had a sighting, I think, while he was traveling in an automobile sometime in that time period. And I don't know if we've got all those details, but in my book, I think I write about his observation of a very bright light, circular beam of light in the missile field, at the missile field, while he was driving an automobile. But yeah, there are other witnesses to other events, and I didn't put all that in the book, but there are other military witnesses to similar events there at Malmstrom and other bases that I do write about.
The incident that you were involved in, the UFO that was above ground, it didn't do anything hostile at all, I suppose. It just hovered there while it was doing what it was doing to the missiles.
Yeah, as far as we can tell, it didn't do anything hostile. It didn't do any damage either at our launch control center facility or at where the missiles were located at the launch facility. And I just want to point out that I couldn't open the door to our capsule, underground capsule, obviously because of a potential for, let's say, unwanted individuals coming in and taking over our facility. So we had very strict security procedures for when we could and could not open the large blast door that kept us locked in for 24 hours. So it's not like I could have run up and taken a look at this object. We weren't allowed to do that.
Okay, so your shift was a 24-hour shift, and you were kind of locked in underground, almost like a prisoner. But
yeah, we could open that door from time to time for meals, but we could not leave that underground facility until we were relieved by another crew, and we had, again, strict security procedures for doing that. So we were relieved the next morning, and the first thing I did was go up and talk to that guard who I spoke to, and I think he was very reluctant to speak with me because he had probably already been told not to speak with me or anyone else about the incident. This was complete cover-up after it occurred. Like I said, we were helicoptered back to the base and ordered to go to our squadron commander's office. I walk in there and start quizzing my squadron commander as to whether or not this was some sort of Air Force exercise that we experienced. And he assured me it was not. And he could not explain any of what happened. It was a big mystery to him, too. And There was another man from Air Force Office of Special Investigation, AFOSI, in the office, and really all he wanted to do, he didn't necessarily ask me any questions about what happened. He just wanted us to sign these non-disclosure agreements with specified serious punishments for speaking if we spoke with anyone at all, either in the Air Force or out. We could not speak of this in perpetuity. I can go into how it is I was finally able to come forward, or thought I could. Yeah, if you'd like, I can.
Was it that in some way it got declassified?
Well, in 1994, I was about to retire from my job with the Federal Aviation Administration. I was out of the service. I resigned in 1971, and but I had been working for Federal Aviation Administration as an aircraft certification engineer in structural engineer. And I worked for them for about 21 years, and I was about to retire, and I decided to become a teacher. And so I was going to school at the University of Washington to get my teaching credential. Happened to go into the bookstore there and saw a title that caught my interest. It's title of the book is Above Top Secret by Timothy Good. You may have heard of Timothy Good. Very good book, a fairly large book, but I picked it up and happened to turn to page 301 of that book. So if you got a copy of it, you can turn to page 301 and you'll see a short paragraph on that states to the effect that flight of missiles in Montana in 1966 and 1967 was disabled during a UFO encounter. It sounded so much like what I experienced. And remember, I had not spoken to anybody in all that time from 1967 to 1994, 27 years, I guess, about this. So I was astonished that it was in a book. I took the chance. I went home and actually told my wife for the first time. I bought the book and took it home and showed it to her. And it was recommended that I try to contact Mutual UFO Network and report it. Well, I didn't want to do anything like that until I had some documents to back me up. So I asked a member of MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, an investigator by the name of James Klotz, to help me submit a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, where you can inquire to the government about material that could be declassified. So we requested a declassification of any information about these incidents. And I told him not to say anything about UFOs. So we did that. And lo and behold, the Air Force wrote back and said these incidents were classified. However, that because of the time lapse, they're going to go ahead and declassify the Echo Flight incident. And so they did. And they started sending me reports, telegrams. I got quarterly reports required of the wing at the base. And in one of those quarterly reports, of course, the one first quarter of 1967, it did talk about the Echo Flight shutdown. In there, it mentioned rumors of UFOs. It also mentioned studies that were being done or investigations that were being done of this incident. And so I decided, I thought this was my incident. I really did. I thought, well, this is what happened to me there. And I had forgotten what my commander had told me way back 27 years earlier about another incident similar to ours that occurred. So at any rate, I went public and started speaking to, I gave an interview to the Great Falls Tribune, a newspaper in Montana, that right outside the base. I also went on the Art Bell show. I don't know if you heard of Art Bell. He was a radio celebrity speaking of paranormal. And I, as a result of that interview on his program, I did get some people come forward who were happened to be witnesses to parts of this story. And one of them was Robert Kaminsky, who was head of the Boeing team that investigated the Echo flight shutdown. And he gave me a lot of details in writing about what they did and how they investigated it and what they eliminated as a potential cause, things like that. So I was getting some help after that. And then it wasn't until late 1996 that I finally contacted Colonel Maiwald, who was my commander in the Launch Control Center on the evening of my incident. And he told me, he said, we were not at Echo Flight, we were at Oscar Flight. But by then, I had already gone public. But technically, I'm still, to this day, I'm in violation of that NDA.
And you haven't had anything, like, come back to you?
No. Unusual.
Have you had guys come to you kind of asking for anonymity or secrecy and just saying, what happened to you sort of happened to me as well, but please don't tell anybody about it?
Yes. Yes, I have had people like that, very credible witnesses. By the way, I was also able to contact the commander and deputy commander of Echo Flight. That's the flight that occurred on March, the incident that occurred on March 16th, 1967. Mine occurred on March 24th. So 8 days earlier, the very similar incident that is covered by the documents that were sent to me, the Echo Flight incident, occurred. And I've got him on audio tape with his permission. And I've got a couple of letters from the commander, James Carlson, of that crew of that incident. And you can find all of this on my website, by the way. I'll give that. It's spiralgalaxy.org. Anybody can go to that website, spiralgalaxy, all one word, .org. Listen to these audio tapes that I've just referenced. They can see some of the other documents on there also. I've also got a YouTube channel by the name of Bob Solace, where people can watch other material that substantiates what I've just said. In addition, I have given a complete report to the AARO group, which stands AARO, AARO. Stands for All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. It's the office in the U.S. government that's supposed to be collecting information from witnesses about their events related to the UAP subject. And again, I presented them with a lot of documentation and the audio testimony that I just talked about.
Because you say in the book that, was that February 15th, 2023? It was a two-hour interview you did with them.
That's correct, yeah. That's correct.
And what was their demeanor? Did they really take this very seriously?
Yes, they were very respectful, took it seriously. In fact, they wrote me nice comments in a letter, email, that they appreciated my professionalism and the details I presented to and all of it would be going into a historical record, which they're required to do. So any congressman, certainly in the U.S., or senator, can access my full report through Arrow. And in fact, I taped the entire session with the knowledge of Arrow. I told him I was going to do that. And so it's recorded on audio. And in fact, I think I also either referenced it in the book, but I have a part of that recording on my website.
And did this go on to affect, is it the National Defense Authorization Act? And there's something new coming in with that next year?
Yes, matter of fact, it's being considered right now. The National Defense Authorization Act was amended to include, for example, whistleblower protections last year. Every year, of course, our government has to be funded, and this National Defense Authorization Act is part of that defense funding. It details the kind of funding the Defense Department will get for the following fiscal year. This year, there was an amendment proposed by the Senate that is now being reviewed by the House of Representatives. And it requires all agencies in the U.S. government to report on and submit any data or artifacts, information about artifacts and data covering the UAP subject. And it goes into some great detail on defining those terms and what's required and timelines when it has to be submitted, etc. In addition, it would require establishing a review committee that would review classified UAP information and recommend any declassification of that information. So it's a fairly robust bill that provides for disclosure. So it's important. Right now it's being discussed, like I said, or argued over in the House, and we're all hoping and anticipating that the bill will go through as written, as I just described to you, and won't be weakened because, of course, we have to consider the fact that many of these congressmen have donors to their campaigns by aerospace companies that have been a part of the ongoing cover-up of information on the UAP and have been running projects for the government because it's becoming obvious that we have recovered craft and indeed possibly organic material from the occupants of those craft.
With the cover-up, it started way back in 1947, didn't it, with the Roswell?
Well, at least 47. There was an incident, I don't know if you're familiar with it, called the Battle of L.A. in 1942. It happened in around February, March 1942, where a blimp-like object was seen over Los Angeles. And very quickly, you can actually see a photograph if you, it was taken by the Los Angeles Times photographer, of these searchlights in the sky focused on this object that looked to the, you know, it was described as blimp-like, but you know, people will recognize it as a fairly common UFO object. Anyway, pursuit aircraft were sent to bring this object down or have it fly off away from the population of Los Angeles. And there were actually anti-aircraft guns fired at this object, anti-aircraft shells, and thousands of shells, in fact. And this all happened just after the U.S. was started their involvement in World War II. Like I said, February of 1942. So there's information about that on the internet. I'm sure you can find it. But of course, this was not called a UFO or anything like that. But it was a very strange occurrence. And of course, during World War II, there were the Foo Fighters that were reported by bomber pilots flying their missions. So it's possible that these objects were being seen by Air Force pilots way before 1947.
And do you feel that it was with, perhaps it was Roswell, where there was the press release that came out from the airfield saying that they've managed to get hold of one of these flying discs, and then the next day another press release comes out and says it's just a weather balloon? You think that there may have been some panic or something at high level, and where they said, we can't let this get out, we got to get control of this?
Yeah, I think that's when the major cover-up started, because we have, I think, in the hundreds of witnesses that can testify to the reality of the Roswell crashes. There were two of them, and many witnesses saw the debris field. It was not any kind of a balloon or aircraft, as the anything known to the Air Force at the time. And so, like I said, in the hundreds of witnesses, that most of whom were threatened, not to speak of things, there was a strong effort to recover all parts and pieces of the debris. Of course, there's some well-written books on the subject. And like you say, after the initial press release, this was an official press release from the base to the press that there had been a recovery of a saucer-shaped craft. The next day, it was denied by higher-ups in the Air Force, and because they probably received orders from above them to deny it, and it's been denied since.
And you also mention in the book that witnesses that were there at the time were threatened with their lives and the lives of their children.
Yes.
But some of the witnesses have come forward over the decades, but I don't think there was any, nobody ever came to visit them.
Well, I don't know which book you're referring to. If I'll refer your audience to a book called Witness to Roswell by Don Schmidt and the other author, co-author, I can't remember his name right now, but They specify in particular that many witnesses were threatened. In addition, there are affidavits that are held in the museum at Roswell, New Mexico. There is a pretty well-stocked museum and library of statements made by witnesses that will verify what I just told you.
So if we can move forward in time, could you tell us what happened to you in 1985 at Manhattan Beach?
Oh, well, that was my abduction experience. 1985, I was living in Manhattan Beach with my wife and two children. One evening, I woke up in the middle of the night and saw a bluish light emanating from our living room. And we didn't have any blue lights in our living room, but we could see it. I could see it from the bedroom. And I woke up my wife. I asked her if she saw the blue light, and she said yes. And I told her, well, I'm going to have to get up and investigate. We might have somebody in the house. So I started to get up off the bed, and I couldn't. I was paralyzed. And by the way, what I'm about to disclose here is I received, as a result of having hypnotic regressions. Actually, I have had four of them so far.
Okay.
Probably have another one in the future. But so I started to get up and I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. And I recall specifically, very vividly, working so hard to get my mobility back, and I couldn't. I was completely paralyzed. This was not a dream. This was not a dream. I remember fear I had, and I'll mention a couple other things as I go, but I couldn't move. I asked for help from my wife, and now she was unconscious and unavailable to me. So I had, next thing I remember is seeing some sort of person or being, a hooded figure in the doorway of our bedroom. Now, I could not make out a face. I mean, I have not been able to describe what the face looked like. All I remember was dark, and, but it had a hood on. Soon after that, I recall sensing that there were small beings in the room, and even thought they were children. They were childlike size, small children. That was my sense of it at the time. Next thing I recall is being lifted off the bed and floated towards the window of our bedroom. I recall locking that window and felt that these children did not know how to unlatch the window, but they didn't have to. They took me right through the window. I know that sounds ridiculous. There was no broken glass or anything, but I went right through the window. This is how I recall it. And on the other side was our backyard, and it was all lit, very brightly lit up. Next thing I recall was being on a, looked to me like or felt like a medical operating table. And I was being shown a long needle by these long, being held by these long bony fingers, very long bony fingers. So at any rate, they were holding it up to my eyes and communicating with me telepathically that they were going to insert this in my groin area, but it would not hurt. But when they started to do that, the pain was unbearable. It was the worst pain I've ever felt. I communicated that to them. Again, telepathically, I don't recall saying anything verbally. And the pain went away immediately. After that, I recall being sitting up on this table and being escorted by two of these small beings. And we floated over to the side of the ship and sat down into appeared to be a molded seating on the side of this craft that I was in. And these two sentries, escorts, were on either side of me. But a while later, I was taken to another cubicle in the ship, and another being was there and turned me around and poked two fingers down my spine. That was it. Turned me around, and then I was escorted out. Again, we were floating all this time. We weren't walking. And we floated down along this corridor. It was curved, and then there was a bright light flash, and I was back in my bed. Now, the next day, neither my wife nor I spoke of this. We didn't have any recollection of it, really. In 2008, I believe it was, so about 23 years later, we were at a conference in Ireland, Carrick-on-Shannon, Ireland. And one of the speakers there at this conference, my wife and I were sitting together and listening to one of the speakers who was an experiencer or abductee, and he said, and then a blue light filled my bedroom. And I turned to my wife and I said, do you recall a blue light in our bedroom a long time ago? And she said, yes. So she too had recalled as this speaker was stating this. So that was confirmation enough for me to get the hypnotic regression sessions, which I got one that very evening with Mary Rodwell, who was an Australian lady who works with abductees. She happened to be there. So that's when I started, like I said, one of the first of four regressions I've had. And that's about it.
And has this changed your opinion of other people who are experiencers like this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I certainly am convinced that abductions are very much a part of this phenomenon. People have been taken. Many, many people have been taken in this way. So the question is why? You know, why are being people, humans, being taken by extraterrestrials? And one of the other conclusions come to is that they, whoever they are producing hybrids. In other words, combination beings between humans and themselves. So, again, why? What's the purpose of that? And that, of course, is a subject of speculation. We all have our thoughts about that.
I wanted to ask you about part of your book that's called Psych Job, where you were ordered to a meeting with the base psychiatrist.
Yes.
Why do you think they would do that? Because, as you said, you didn't need to see a psychiatrist.
Exactly. This happened a couple of years after my incident in 1967. In 1969, I was ordered to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the home of Blue Book. But at that time, the Condon investigation had just been completed, and the Air Force was declaring they would no longer investigate UFOs. However, that was not the truth. They continued investigating UFOs and have to the present day. But I was ordered back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in order to complete my master's degree program, which I started at Malmstrom. One of the perks there at Malmstrom was that we were had the choice of taking classes for advanced degrees. So I was in an advanced program to get a master's degree in aerospace engineering, which I eventually did. But I could have finished the program there, but they ordered me to go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. At one point, right soon after I got there, I encountered an old classmate. Actually, it was a year ahead of me from the Air Force Academy where I went to school. And he informed me that he was happy to see me, and it was going to, they had a job waiting for me. I said, "What kind of a job?" I'm just here to finish my degree. And then a little after that, I got a call from the base psychiatrist's office saying that they wanted to confirm my appointment on such and such a date. And I said, "I never made that appointment, and I have no reason to see a psychiatrist. I have not complained to anyone about any mental health issues." So, but again, I was ordered to go to this appointment, and so I did. Showed up, asked the sergeant there who was manning the desk what this was all about. He said they would explain it to me, and so have a seat. We'll wait for the doctor to call you in. And a little while later, he comes over to me and says the doctor will see you now. And by this time, though, I've been thinking about this. If the subject of my UFO event at Malmstrom came up and they allowed me to speak about it, well, this could go on my medical record. And they would have some control over me and my career in the Air Force. So I said, I don't want to go back there. I'd like the doctor to come out here and explain to me why I'm here. And now this doctor, of course, was a full colonel, and I was a mere captain at the time. So he goes back. Speaks to the doctor again. The doctor and the sergeant comes back out and says, "Sir, you can go now." So there was no, explanation. I never received any explanation as to why they wanted me to keep this appointment. But I suspect, because of the timing, I remember the early 1969, the Air Force issued a statement on UFOs stating that they would no longer be investigating UFO reports as a result of recommendations they got from the Condon or University of Colorado investigation on UFOs, which they had orchestrated to be a whitewash anyway. But because of that timing, I was thinking I did not want to be a part of any secret or classified program studying UFOs. And I think they were trying to recruit people to do just that. Later on, it was... I'd say a couple of weeks later, I was at the base officers club having dinner with a girlfriend who I later married. I get a a man come up with me to me and ask if I was Bob Solace, and said yes. And he said he wanted to talk to me, and we talked about him being my roommate. And he was a helicopter pilot, and that we would be working together. I said, I don't know anything about this. I'm not going to have any roommates. I intend to get married to this lady that I had a date with that night. So that was very strange. In other words, it indicated to me again that somehow they were going to recruit me to be a part of some group that used helicopters. And so this is how I've come to the conclusion that this is another way they have witnesses to keep witnesses from talking. And that is, they read them in some extent on the phenomenon and the secrets. And that's how they keep them in line, in control.
Well, we've been talking about your book. It's called UAPs and the Nuclear Puzzle, Visitations, National Security, and the Need for Transparency. And that's on Amazon, and you've got other books out as well. Could you tell us about those?
Well, the first book I wrote was called Fated Giant. And that was a terminology used for a nuclear incident by the Air Force at one time. But it describes it. It has many of the documents I received under the Freedom of Information Act in the appendix, so people can actually read the documentation that we received initially. So it goes into some detail on my incident. However, it has some mistakes. I claim in there that I was at Echo Flight, like I said. So that's erroneous. Of course, I was at Oscar Flight, and I didn't find that out till after this book was published. But like I said, it's got a lot of good documentation in there. The next book I wrote was called Unidentified UFO Phenomenon, where I go into much of what I discussed today. And then my recent book was really a rewriting of that second book to bring it up to date, bring the information up to date, and talk about the risk of nuclear war more, and also the activities of the U.S. government to disclose what they know or not disclose. That's still a question.
Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been great talking to you.
Good talking to you, Simon, and thank you for the invitation. Appreciate it. This is a serious story. I hope your audience will take the time, take a look at what I've got on my website and my YouTube channel. And there's a lot of material to digest, but this is a real phenomenon, and I hope more will come. More information will come forward.
Yeah, and thanks again. And that was an interview with Robert Salas about his book, UAPs and the Nuclear Puzzle, Visitations, National Security, and the Need for Transparency. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can hear the extended episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast. There are over 290 episodes. On the Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of an afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of Past Lives Podcast every Thursday called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. And my Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. And is there any part of you that regrets not going into it and gaining a whole ton more information on this stuff and what they were doing?
Not seriously. I mean, from time to time, I think, gee, you know, I missed an opportunity to find out what was going on here. But with that comes other headaches. In other words, for example, I couldn't have gone public with my story. They would have had more control over it.